Blog Talk Radio.
Live from the nation's capital, it's Quintessential Listening, Poetry, with host Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram.
Month, and QLP joins the countless others to help celebrate her story. Her story is the story of women poets who've helped to shape our world. These women lift their pens to fight for rights, to live free of discrimination and stereotypes, to break free from the rules set forth by men, by family, and society, and to just be themselves. Reading tonight will be acclaimed poets Francine Montemuro, Pamela L. Taylor, and Lynn Spiegel-Maravitti. Therefore, without further ado, I give you Francine Montemuro.
Hello.
Good evening.
Good evening. Good evening. Thank you for allowing me to be on this show. I'm going to start with a poem that's fairly new called Slaughterhouse Moms. Researchers unpacked boxes of lined legal pads and number two pencils, found places high up in the abattoir, and watched the workers below. The workers are mothers in white aprons stained from working the blood pit where the beasts fight back and the mothers get mad and the meanness creeps in. The researchers watch the mothers slit the throats of old dairy cows and split themselves in two. Every mother delivered her twin. One twin skinned the heifers, the other mapped bus routes to her daughter's soccer game. One twin checked the kill line, sent the final bolt shock to the skull. The other cheered when her girl scored a goal. The unseen doppelganger divided them and made them whole. It got them through the day when work called for the soul. It's what came with the hourly wage. The work of mothering eased recollection of the beasts, their panicked eyes, their screams. Evenings, one twin was furloughed while the other washed and braided her little girl's hair, sometimes jerking the hairbrush a little harder than needed. When the researchers left, they took home a theory and compiled the data. Their sleep was uneasy. They waited for accolades. When the mothers clocked out, they went home to bathe their daughters with soap that smelled of sandalwood. When they slept, the clean scent of their girls' hair clung to their fingers, and the boom of the bolt shock rang in their dreams. Okay, that was a new one. This is kind of an older one. An oldish one. It refers to a place called San Mauro Forte, which is way in the south of Italy. And in the early 1900s, many Italians who emigrated from San Mauro Forte landed in the city of Yonkers, just north of the Bronx, and they formed an enclave, and my father's people were among them. This is called Pioneers. On Sundays when it rained, the uncles sat on porches smoking White Owl cigars, sat with feet propped on wrought iron railings through to evening when talk was muted by gutters brimmed and thrummed, sat while aunts turned and spied and glowered from clean, dry kitchens. On Sundays when it rained, the uncles watched clouds of cigar smoke drift into nothing on dusky dampness, retold stories of the old country, of soil too parched to till, of families large, close, and shielding, of ocean crossings alone and in steerage, of stillborn babies buried in potter's fields, of red wine pressed in basements and drunk without haste, of hope for the children of the pioneers of San Mauro Forte. On Sundays when it rained, the uncles sat on porches, the aunts spied from kitchen, the smoke wafted off, and I watched the tips of the white owls glow and fade, wondering if you could see those tiny embers all the way down to the Yonkers city line. Okay, I'll do another one, which I wrote in memory of my mother, whose name was Elsie Demizio Montemora. This one is called Keepsakes. Keepsakes. My mother was not a collector. She didn't keep what she couldn't use, but for two slips of paper she kept tucked beneath socks in her dresser. Two slips of paper, two certificates of birth, two names for one baby girl, both signed in a shaky hand by the white-haired man who delivered her one March morning in 1921 in the small stucco house in the immigrant quarter of Yonkers. He held my mother, a tiny, undersized thing without affection, smacked her bottom, and waited for the wail. He felt more scorn than sympathy at the faint chirp that emerged. He set her down, gathered his greatcoat, collected his fee, and said of my mother on his way out, "That one probably won't make it." My grandmother, still nearly a child herself, raised her head, peered at her runty daughter, and mumbled a prayer to the Blessed Mother. Perhaps it was that prayer answered that helped my mother defy the white-haired man's glum prognosis, and that blessed her with the perfect pitch soprano that soothed her through decades of sorrow. Even now, I can hear her at Sunday Mass, outshining the choir at St. Matthew's. At home, joining Ella Fitzgerald on the hi-fi, her voice steady, reassuring, and just ahead of the harmony. Prophetically, my grandparents named her for St. Cecilia, the patron saint of song, but they struggled with the language and got the spelling wrong twice. Cecilia, Esercelia, no matter. The two names, the two certificates, came to be keepsakes, and they all came to call my mother Elsie, a name that took hold and stayed long after the white-haired man left. I think I will do another one that is called Annuals. Annuals. Your husband walked off in the fall and didn't come back in the spring. The house is empty now. The summer garden you crammed with perennials is wild, dense with weeds. You quit your home, and with it your cream coreopsis, your baby blue hollyhocks, your champagne foxglove, everything that returned faithfully year after year, no matter how cold the winter. Your new flat has enough space for some annuals. You give them soil, sunlight, a single season to flower, set seed, and die. You line the sills of the bay window with clay pots, fill them with sage, lemon balm, thyme, and cilantro. You sprout catnip, too, for feral cats in the back alley. The summer breeze sends waves of mismatched fragrance through the screen. You set 10-gallon urns on your tiny back terrace. By August, they overflow with ginger-torched geranium, scarlet salvia, fireblast marigolds, and blood-red petunias. No pastels in your potted garden. Everything in shades of rage, sizzling harlot colors, screaming for attention. Okay. Well, I think I will move on to one that gets back to my family, which influences some of my poems. And this one I wrote in honor of my father, and I wrote in honor of my father who always looked out for us the best he could. This one is called Where Drunk Men Might Go. The block where I grew up, on the north edge of Yonkers, had a 4-acre woodlot. Swampy, overrun by vines and trees, it was a place for dumping yard waste, old cars, and appliances. It was a wilderness for two girls on the outskirts. It was a place of our making. We were Diana the Huntress, orphans befriended by wolves, sister warriors, guided by ghosts. We wore war paint for courage, performed miracles with creek water, and spoke to animals in a language passed down from grandmothers. We made a private homestead in the cave of lost souls. It was just the carcass of a Ford sedan. We warded off bad luck and spells with a garland of plumage plucked from the spirit bird. Just some feathers from a pigeon that got hit by a car. It was a place our world stretched beyond the parkways and sidewalks that hemmed us in. A place that vanished the morning my father looked up from his coffee and spotted us with our spears and our treasure map headed toward the sheltering woods. He called out from the front stoop, hurried us back home, reminded us that wild animals and open streams brought on brain fevers and biting mites and who knows what else. He forbade us from exploring the dark universe he feared. He chided our wildness, warned us against wandering like motherless imps in shadowy places where drunk men might go. That one was in honor of my dad. And let's see. I have enough time to do, I think, one more. And I think this one I'll read. It's a little, I'll read this as an older one. This one was from my mom. It's called Nothing But Light. My mother doesn't need much now. Not the closet full of clothes I will comb through to find something suitable for the service, or the boxes of dry macaroni I will give to the food bank, or the jars of sauce she's put up for the winter, or the coupons she's clipped from the Sunday papers. It's warm in here, but I'm glad for the white sheets they've given her for covers. She's modest and funny that way, and for the morphine drip that keeps her out of pain, though she's not one to complain. People have come to her with tales about the weather she cannot hear, flowers with fragrance she cannot smell, candy from the gift shop she cannot eat, greeting cards from Hallmark she cannot read. Mom, I hope to come to you with nothing but light, some comfort, some gentleness to guide you home. So that about 15 minutes. Maybe I'll do one short.
Please.
One short
please,
one.
Please do one more, please.
Okay, this is a short one which I can squeeze in. This is called Mud. Weighty, sticky, black as tar spring mud, home to worms and bog moss and primordial mystery, clinging to paws and high tops and squishing between toes, staining shirts, socks, and carpets, and reaching for the hem of your new skirt. Welcome back, spring mud, now to your noble task, beckoning back swallows and bluebirds, and breathing new life into primrose, dogwood, and sweet William. The end.
All right. Thank you so much. Let me ask this question. Beautiful, beautiful work. I'm going to ask two questions. Number
okay.
one, what does poetry yeah. mean to you? What does poetry mean to you?
What
Why
does
it
mean? What it is to me, it's something I can't get away from. I've written probably very crummy poems since when I was little, but it is something that I think helps us connect. You know, if I hold up a mirror to myself, sometimes you see yourself in that mirror, in that reflection, and that is what connects us across across sort of the boundaries of whatever it is that makes us human. I read your poetry, I get it. It means something to me. We're connected. That's what it means to me. That's why it's important to me. If you ever read a poem that makes the hair on your arm kind of stand up because it's so meaningful, even though you may not have had that experience. So that's what it means to me, Michael, I think.
All right. Well, a slightly different question. Who are you as a result of being a poet? Slightly different.
Well, that's a good question. I think I'm someone who is perhaps more reflective than if I didn't write poetry,
right.
because I think what happens is I write poetry, and because there's something rattling around in my head that needs to get out. It may not be new, it may not be completely fascinating, but there's something that I need that needs to express itself. And sometimes that doesn't hit until the end of the poem. Sometimes I'm not really even sure where the poem is heading. But it helps me be more reflective because I'm trying to work out something, trying to get my hands, my brain wrapped around something. And I think it makes me a more reflective person.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And hopefully we'll have an opportunity for you to share some more of your work tonight before we leave. All right?
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, Francis. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be right back. My name is Michael Anthony Ingram, and welcome to Quintessential Listening Poetry. Tonight we're joined again by three very, very fantastic poets. Our next poet is Pamela L. Taylor. Pamela, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
Oh, you're more than welcome. You're on.
Well, thank you. So I'm going to start with two poems about my parents, about each of my parents. My mom, who is still alive and probably listening, and my dad, who passed away in 2003.
All right.
So the first poem is Siri as My Mother. I can follow her directions if I listen without thinking. Sometimes she gets confused about where I am, thinks I'm on a different path, then tries to correct me when she's the one who is wrong. She doesn't drive, but insists that her way is the fastest route. Her guidance doesn't make it easier. She's never been on this road. During rush hours, she likes to tell me to turn left onto a busy street at an intersection with no stoplight. How am I supposed to do that? She repeats herself, then waits for me to figure it out. The next poem is called At Night I Dream of Trains, and my father was a train operator for the New York City Transit. At night I dream of trains, the maze of stairs, the ramp leading me to the next platform, the slow crawl of bodies, the pardon me, excuse me, they don't seem to hear, my half walk, half jog through the bowels of my native city, the worried pacing, waiting in the middle, thinking I'm safe, the train with two cars, the doors that don't open, my run, turn, sprint, shoving people through the doors like they do in Japan, except this is not Japan. The sideways sway of metal moving through underground tunnels, blurring the blue and white tiled station names, the slow ride or stuck train, enough time for anxiety to creep into my throat, my panicked heart clutching for a miracle or luck or whatever power to jumpstart the journey again, my brother shouting where to cross the tracks, my sister waiting on the opposite side, my father no longer wearing his transit uniform, seeing him there, wrapping my arms around his waist, carrying my grief into the dark morning, my father telling me which ramp, which train, which subway car, my father holding me for as long as I need before I go. So I'm very happy to share some new poems that I envision as part of a full-length collection that's tentatively titled Dear Husband, and several of the poems are addressed to this future spouse, and others provide some insight into my personal history that I'm sort of bringing into this, you know, future relationship. So I'm going to start with one of the poems addressed to this future spouse. Dear husband, sometimes our happiness suffocates me. I leave you in the morning dark to wander, to feel the air prick the lining of my lungs. I need to remember how it feels to be lonely. I wander past the bars where I used to sit with cognac as company. When I finally let you in, I hoped I would never be lonely again. I return to our home. Your breath fills the rooms. I slip into our bed. You do not stir. Wander is not the same as stray. So the next two poems recall some of my not-so-great dating experiences. This first poem is written like a summary of a social psychological experiment. The only thing that you really need to know is that the term confederate refers to the person who is helping the researcher conduct the study by interacting with the subject. So this one is called Blind Date Experiment. White male subject, 175.25 centimeters tall, 84 kilograms, 52.75 years of age. Black female confederate, 161.5 centimeters tall, 64 kilograms, 45.0833 years of age. The subject is told to meet his date at a bookstore. He is given her name and how she is dressed. Gray top, blue jeans, carrying a black wrap. The subject walks to the back of the store, searches near the fiction section, then walks to the front. He He glances at her description on his phone as he moves towards the racks of magazines and new releases. He pauses to finger the latest Murakami novel. The subject checks his phone again, then heads toward the staircase. The Confederate, who has been standing by the magazine rack for 5 minutes, steps in his path and asks if Brian is his name. The subject stops. His right hand covers his heart before quickly extending it. The Confederate records the subject's reaction, how high the eyebrows arch, how wide eyes and pupils expand. A conditioned response to an aversive stimulus. And so this next one was recently published online in the Adirondack Review. The Last Good Moment. The morning after that dinner, we stood in the kitchen, arms wrapped around each other, my head on your chest, your chin resting on my forehead. I wanted to tell you that I didn't mean to say that I tolerated when you sat beside me at the restaurant. I wanted to explain that public displays of your affection sometimes makes me feel like I'm on display as a black woman dating a white man. I could have whispered this to your heart, but I let us stand there, breathing each other in. 20 minutes later, we walked to our cars, like a normal couple, readying ourselves for work. Your briefcase and button down, my everything bag stuffed with papers. I declared the last week of August as the end of summer, but you said summer had some fight left. So the next poem reveals a little bit more about part of my family story. 1 degree. We're in the car where my mother says, "There's your uncle." He's dressed in a camouflage baseball cap, white shirt, and dark pants, lumbering down the street with 2 canvas bags. She supposes he's going to pay for his storage unit. It's the end of the month. She doesn't know where he sleeps or who else gives him money. The last time I came home, he stopped by smelling sickly sweet like the roses in hospitals 2 days after someone died. I pretended to be asleep. Seeing him reminds me that I am 1 degree away from wandering these streets with a radio, a clean outfit, word puzzles, and whatever else I can carry. The next day, I was in a hurry to leave Queens. There's only so much I can take of the piles of broken and unused things. The flowers allowed to die, their petals dried and brown in untouched heaps. I stopped at McDonald's to get breakfast. If I had gone through the drive-thru, I wouldn't have seen my uncle sitting at a table in a trance-like nod, same clothes. Part of me wanted to take my order and get on the road. No one would have known except me and my mother's God. I went over not for his sake, but for mine. The karma I buy in the hopes that in 30 years, one of my nephews will pull out all the money in his wallet and crumple the bills into my hand. So the next poem is a rather long poem. It sort of chronicles a day in the life of me as a black person living in Boston, the sense of loneliness I feel. And sometimes I just have to count the number of black people that I see in a day. So this poem is about that.
counting Boston. Number one, my face in the mirror, brushing my teeth. Usually, I don't count myself. Number three, the homeless man I always see sitting on the bench, even at 6:15 a.m., if I choose to walk that way. I never speak, and neither does he. I can count on that. Number 6, 7, 8, and 9. Which number are you? I close my eyes and recount. I am one today. The jogger with the Michelle Obama arms, homeless man in front of Dunkin' Donuts, the woman and her tiny child dressed in bright orange. I may have seen a black man walking in a red shirt while I was sitting at the cafe, but I can't be sure. Now it's you, an older man, bald head, flared nose, large duffel bag at your feet, wearing an oversized sweatshirt on this 80-degree day. You could be my uncle riding these trains. At Kenmore, you were replaced by a younger black man, uniformed, red tie falling short of the slight belly bulge, keys jangling from the belt loop of his blue chinos. With a smile and an accent I don't recognize, he pauses his conversations to tell me to write down his name, John. And then I remember the man driving the train. Numbers 21 through 23. I look up from my book and see a family, a father with his daughter and son. The men wait side by side with their white earbuds while she decides what to order from the food truck. She looks to her father, who opens his wallet. When they walk past, I hear the son say, I can't believe you spent $5 on a drink. I look down at my empty cup, how I thought nothing to pull out the five singles and gather the quarter in change. Number 24. Teenage black girl with relaxed hair and sunglasses standing in line at the bubble tea truck with a white boy in glasses. She flips her straightened hair, just like those white girls, I bet. Number 25. I see a black man with a child in one stroller. His wife and mother-in-law follow behind, pushing a stroller with the other child. He is the only one in his family. Maybe I should stop counting. Number 30. Four of us have arrived for the book club when the assistant general manager of the restaurant comes out to encourage the group to return. Like me, he wants to see more of us here. 40 plus. I counted past 40 the last time I came to the Greenway. An equal number of men and women. And I didn't even include the merchants at the Black Business Pop-Out. Somehow, that felt like cheating. The last two. On the train home, I look up from Akhmanova's poems and see another couple. His right arm slung over the seat, holding two fingers of her left hand. His shoulder awkward atop the metal bar. The rest of his slim, muscled body relaxed. She sits opposite of me, legs crossed, face unbothered by makeup or worry. She woke up this beautiful, then tied her dreads up in a bun. I stare at his hands as they stroke her knuckles and slide down. They do this even when he's not craning his neck to look at her. I'm stuck at the same lines I've read 10 times before, stealing glances at their fingers, woven together like a sturdy rug. He turns my way as I pretend to glance up from my book. His eyebrows lift to signal that he sees me. Mine do the same. She smiles a faint smile that I return. I want to keep staring, but look down, to hide my shame. And I'm going to end with a poem from my chapbook, My Mother's Child, which came out in 2015 from Hyacinth Girl Press. And this one is about my experiences as a professional Black female. And it's one of my favorites to read. 20 questions for Black professionals. Why do we avoid sitting together at conferences? When did we stop needing each other's company? Are we immune to the loneliness? What would happen if we skipped happy hour? Would affirmative action come to an end? Why do we always feel the need to show our faces? Is it because we are invisible when we're around but noticeably absent when we're not? Why do we care if our colleagues feel left behind? Can't they fend for themselves? Or is it too cruel to let them live in our world, even for a moment? How many of us is too many of us at the table? 3, 4, or just the one seated at the head? Speaking of which, where are all the Black men? Have we forgotten how to embrace each other? Or am I the only one happy not to be the only one? What if we didn't mind their stares when we stand together talking? Why must white men joke that we're conspiring a takeover when we do? And why aren't we? The end.
Thank you. Beautiful work. Incredible work. A couple of questions for you. What does poetry mean to you? What does poetry mean to you? What is it? Why is it important? That's my question. Why is poetry important?
Why is poetry important to me? Well, I have to say that unlike a lot of poets that I know, I didn't grow up writing poetry in my notebook. Poetry came to me probably somewhere in my 30s. And it's been an important way to really get in touch with some of the feelings that I've perhaps not fully expressed. And for me, it's also in the more that I write poetry and I express these feelings, the more that I realize that there are people who also feel this way but don't have the words for it. So poetry is also a way for me to not just give myself a voice, but give voice to the feelings that other people have that, you know, they may not feel comfortable in sharing. So it's a way to connect to others through being vulnerable on the page.
All right. So you've had opportunities to share your work in this city and other places. Who are you as a result of sharing your work?
That's a great question. I think as a result of sharing my work, you know, I try to make a distinction between people who write poems and people who are poets. You know, because when I share my work, I get a lot of people like, oh, I used to write poetry, but, you know, it's only for myself. Whereas a poet, I think that it is, you're doing it because you are trying to share it. You are trying to make that connection. As a poet, I noticed that my powers of observation, how I see things, how I see the world, how I see events unfold, how I see the trees is a lot different than the people around me who aren't perhaps noticing things. So I think also as a poet, it's my responsibility to bring those things to light that we might be missing or we might not want to see but have to face the truth. So I think that's part of it as well.
Well, I'd like you to come back at the end of the program and share another of your works, if that's okay.
Sure thing.
All right. Thank you very much, Pamela. We'll be right back, everyone. Quintessential Listening Poetry. The call-in number is 646-787-1631. If you have a question for one of our speakers tonight, I'd like to bring on now Lynn Spiegelmeyer-Vitti. Lynn, you're on.
All right. I'm going to start with a poem that is actually in a memorial for my poetry mentor, the late Sam Cornish, who was Poet Laureate of Boston for several years and used to run wonderful poetry workshops at the Boston Public Library. And he really mentored a lot, so many poets, encouraged so many poets. So this is actually a poem that I wrote for a memorial that we had recently, all the people whom he touched in the world of poetry. And I think I was surprised to know that I had known Sam longer than anyone else. And this is the poem that tells that story. At the Foghorn Folk Club, 1964. Tall, awkward boy, a transplant from Oregon, carrying a beat-up paperback copy of On the Road, strap hanging on the number 3 bus, asks me, "You like poetry?" I nod. He tells me, "You have to go hear this cat read his stuff. A black dude, he's real, man. Get there before the show, before the folk singers, down on West 22nd Street. You dig?" I want to roll my eyes at this farm kid from the West who thinks he's cool. But I take note, the Foghorn. I check the listings in the Baltimore Sun, below the Flicks, above the Gaiety Burlesque ad. I tell my mother I'm going to a poetry reading as if in a college lecture hall on a school night. I'm the youngest there. People sit around drinking beer or spiked cider. A young man, bespectacled, dressed in brown corduroys, crewneck sweater, steps onto the stage. Cheers and foot stomping greet him. He's here to be heard by the faithful. He recites his poems, declaims them. I've never heard a poet not in real life. The nuns have played records of Dylan Thomas, of Eliot, in English class, but nothing like this, a real poet, not a dead white one, standing so near I could shake his hand. He is mesmerizing. He looks at us through thick eyeglasses. He speaks in the vernacular. I came for his poetry, and when he was done, I went home to make curfew. I didn't come for the guitars and banjos, the mandolins and Woody Guthrie tunes. I came for Sam Cornish. I came for the poetry. I'm going to read some of my works in progress right now. This is a chapbook that I've been laboring over, and it's the title came to me before any of the poems, and the title of the collection is Greenwich Mean Time. So I'll just start with some of these, and I'm going to take them roughly in chronological order. The first one is called Love Drunk. We said our vows in the Lady Chapel, celebrated in my family's row house, 50 of us crammed into the rooms I grew up in. We drank too much champagne. My mother whispered it was time for us to leave the party for our weekend honeymoon at your brother's cottage in the valley. I hastily threw my bouquet from the top of the stairs. Your brother's girlfriend caught it. I wonder if she knew all along he was gay. We slept on cotton sheets he had dyed red on the stove. Our life together faltered, then quickly frayed. It seemed to go on so long while we lived it. My memory is blurry, vague, full of omissions, except I remember the tart, crisp champagne, our rich wedding cake, devil's food iced with buttercream, the cool sheets on our first marriage bed, waking up and staring into your ice blue eyes, knowing we couldn't turn off that road we'd set out on. Starter wedding. I had the wedding I wanted, no white dress. I chose a Vogue pattern, the dressmaker sewed it of blue crepe, shoes dyed to match, silk flowers tucked into my hair. The best man said I looked like Elizabeth Taylor. We were standing in the mist at the side door of the Cathedral of Mary our Queen. At the moment, my betrothed and I stood at the altar. Jackie Kennedy was marrying Aristotle Onassis on Scorpios. We all know how that turned out, not exactly a love match. My father wanted a nuptial mask, the Ave Maria sung by a soprano, me kneeling before the Blessed Virgin, laying my bouquet at her feet. But I was marrying a Baptist, so no mass, no Blessed Mother, and I wanted to toss my bouquet. The priest was brief, said the words to constitute the sacrament of matrimony. My uncle was scandalized by my short dress. My mother had handwritten the invitations, short notice. Everyone thought I was pregnant. I cried when my aunt embraced me, handed me a tissue, said, "Don't ruin your makeup. You'll look like a raccoon." My groom wore a bespoke suit. At 24, his hairline was receding. He was beaming. It was the happiest I ever saw him that day when it all seemed promising. Jackie Kennedy and I, brides with different motives. If you'd asked each one of us 6 months later, we might have agreed on this much. Some people get married for the wrong reason. The next poem is the title poem, Greenwich Mean Time. In the time of a war halfway across the world, a war we didn't want, one spurred by old men, we fled the city, taking our books and music, our marriage bed and maplewood table. In my grandmother's red station wagon, up the Henry Hudson Parkway, we rattled along into Westchester, onto the Merritt Parkway, everything we owned stuffed into boxes or pillowcases. We settled into a rented flat over a garage. The kitchen's windows admitted the morning light. We eschewed meat, discovered tofu, kasha, spinach noodles, dined on garbanzo beans and cashew butter. Our paychecks covered rent and gas, groceries, food for the cats we brought home from the pound, a calico and a black one who sucked his paw when he dozed. We learned to drive the steep, snowy road in first gear. The city seemed so distant. The birds that stayed that winter darted from one naked tree branch to the next. Weekends, we lay in bed reading the paper, nestled against each other under the emerald spread. My husband looked for work. In December, sold Christmas trees from a Port Chester lot, freezing his hands so used to office work, the phone, the foolscap writing pads. Our idol frayed at the edges. There were quarrels over nothing or over money. We sold the motorcycle to pay the oil bill. We missed the museums, the subway, the long walks from midtown to home, the news kiosks, the confectionery with the chocolate Florentines. We missed the faces of people we passed on the street. Everyone in suburbia was white with perfect teeth. Everyone seemed happy with the way things were going in the town, in the country, in the broken world. The next one is called Tremont Street Suppers. Nixon was president. We didn't yet see how we'd get rid of him. We were bombing Cambodia. We tuned in nightly to the war summary on WBAI. The men acquired draft deferments by various means. One of them blind in one eye. Another saw a psychoanalyst twice weekly. His parents paid the bills. All but us were unmarried, some coupled, some singletons. There was always flirting. There were assignations wherever young people found themselves. The library, the nature museum on High Ridge Road, the diner in town, the natural food store with the prototype electric cars lined up in the back parking lot waiting for the future. Frugal last-minute potlucks, the main course invariably a vegetarian concoction from a counterculture cookbook. Dessert was a bowl of ice cream with half dozen spoons stuck into the decanted mess or raw almonds dipped into a saucer of honey before the postprandial leaning back to savor the night's music. We wanted the evening to last longer than the workday, wanted love, wanted romance. You and I wanted to be made for each other, even as the others circled around us, patchouli-scented distractions we did not see for the danger they were to us, to our fragile, suspended tandem state. Next one is called Putnam Avenue in Spring. Overnight, melting snow gave way to waves of daffodils smothering the hill near the Protestant church. But churches hung in our peripheral vision, an annoyance, a reminder of what we'd cast off. The public library was our church, the holy source where we laid down a $10 deposit, carried home projector and cans of classic films spooled on reels. On a white sheet tacked on our living room wall, we gazed at sepia images of the little tramp sauntering down the street, swinging his cane, smiling shyly at the girl of his dreams. Scott Joplin rags hummed on our stereo, background sound. We stretched out on the rug, throw pillows under our heads, too tired from the workday, too stoned to make love, like orphaned siblings, a family unto ourselves. This one's called Drinking Games. At dinner, I had too much cheap red wine from free carafes served with the meat and potatoes. I was a mean drunk, carried on about a piano I insisted you buy for me. I snapped my eyeglasses in two in a drunken show of I'll never know. I loved those tortoise frames. A few weeks later, I got sloshed at a party. I'd gone alone. You never liked the Unitarian crowd. They drank scotch before the meal, wine with dinner, brandy after dessert. I've never been so sick in all my life. All night, retching in the bathroom till nothing was left to come up, and I slumped over the basin, holding a cold cloth to my forehead. All the next day, I ate nothing but crushed ice, cursed myself, wondered how I'd gotten home at all. Did I say anything rude or vomit in the powder room before the party ended? There was something I couldn't grab hold of. I only drank with friends or people I wanted as friends. I drank to be someone I wasn't. I drank because it was worse to do nothing, to sit on the front porch by myself, staring at the rose bush by the split rail fence, looking for an exit. Here's one called Dividing the Spoils. On yellow-lined paper, you made a child's drawing, a house with eight windows, a cat on the front steps, smoke curling out of the rectangle meant for a chimney. In each window, a small face and a stick figure hand waving. I want a house full of children, you said, thrilling and scaring me. But when the time came to start a family, I turned away not because I was afraid of bringing a new life into our world, but because the time wasn't right, or never would be. You weren't right for me. The money wasn't there. We needed to be more settled, to know if we'd live here, near the Sound and its gray sand beaches, near the post road, the thruway, the railroad that ran from Virginia to Maine, the freight train's night whistle, music to my dreams. Or would we follow our friends to California, the golden place, Tomorrowland, where hippies and Hell's Angels mingled? Where to get a teaching license, I'd have to be fingerprinted. Inertia got the better of us. We stayed put, moving from Kos Kob to Glenville to Riverside, one bad landlord, too good. And when our life grew too uncertain, I packed up the car with my sewing machine and drove to Boston. I said I needed space, needed time. You understood, or perhaps you only pretended to. It was easy to break free. We saved our only quarrel for the day in the kitchen when we tried to divide three spatulas between us. The neighbors likely heard us carry on that afternoon. I wore you down, left with two good ones. You got the cheap one. Next one is called In Lewisburg, County Mayo, Thinking About Dublin. The smell of burning peat in this steady morning rain suggests a memory out of reach, something from years ago when I got the notion to drain my small savings account, head for Ireland, once final exams were read, grades in, textbooks collected, counted, accounted for, my chairman satisfied that the city of Stamford had gotten its due. I was 26, marriage in shreds, divorce papers drawn up. I was seeking a different self, a poetic self. I stayed a week in Dublin, wandering the paths Joyce describes. Each day I distracted myself, went to the Abbey, met an American actor, a minor figure on the Broadway stage who took me to an after-hours place frequented by the Dublin theater crowd. I could have sworn when we knocked and the actor whispered the password, the man who peeked out and opened the door was Milo O'Shea. The actor and I drank Jameson's neat, sipped it slowly. In Boyle, County Roscommon, town of my great-grandmother, I wandered the cemetery, searching for the Sheikhi graves, the headstones from the days of the great hunger hid in the high grass. I rented a small red Ford, drove across Ireland, slowing down, stopping often for the sheep, accepting waves from farmers as I shifted into first gear, on to the next village, stopping each night to find a room and perhaps supper, supper identical to breakfast, eggs and rashers, brown bread and white, tomato, tea, lashings of butter. I ate too much and drank the Guinness, which fattened me up. I outsized my waistbands. I came home a stone heavier, a bottle of Jameson's in my duty-free bag. Okay, I've got a couple more, and then I'm going to wind up here. Two more. Dissolution. The courtroom's white walls, its wooden benches, made it look more like a congregational church than a place of justice. I waited for my lawyer in the hallway. My girlfriend's conscripted witnesses stood ready. Someone had to be at fault. I played the role of injured party, the wronged one. The judge was inured to these tales of disinterest that bled into rudeness or turned into something short of cruelty. Peccadillos, leaving a party, resenting the wife's work friends, rows about religion, politics, had to be stretched to resemble legal grounds so the state could end what had ended months before. I asked for my maiden name back. I owed the lawyer $400. I forgot what I wore to the end of my marriage. I admit to hyperbole. There was nothing truly cruel, truly intolerable. We were collateral damage in seismic shifts, old rules incinerated, folkways turned into jokes. We flouted boundaries, thinking that was progress. My husband, once beloved, was now my ex. Okay. I'm just going to flip to this last one. Okay. This is actually the last poem in the collection, and I won't say anything more about that. It's called The Friday Night Irregulars. Snow predicted, sun gone earlier than usual. At the post office, technology stalls. Jim, the somber counterman, says, no credit, only debit. I mail a first-class envelope full of poems aimed southwards, where they have 31 more minutes more of daylight today. I don't begrudge those south of here a bit more day. I'm having dinner with the Friday night irregulars, comfort food and a warm fire in the hearth, a full glass of red wine or two, because some days you've got to have the red to see you through these dark nights, the red to accompany the jokes, the talk of politics, the lamentations, the carping, the laughter, beating back the blues. The end.
Wonderful work. Wonderful work. You've had opportunities to travel and share your work. Why is poetry important to you, Lynn?
Well, I think, you know, we often say or heard it said that when one becomes a poet and really commits to it, you use the poetry to speak your truth. And I think, to me, that's a very important part of it. And sometimes it's, you know, very difficult to do that because you have to dig deep and sometimes talk about things that you've never really shared with the public before. So I think that's important, and I think it's important to, and this is something that echoes something that both the poets who've just read, Francine and Pamela, have talked about, which is you speak your truth, but you hope that there's some universality to it. You hope that somebody who hears it, or some many bodies who hear it, many souls who hear it or read it, say, well, that's not my experience exactly. The details are different, but there's a kernel in it that's universal. And I think, to me, it's sort of like putting a note in a bottle and sending it out. You hope that whoever sees it, reads it, hears it, will be able to relate to it.
All right. Well, who are you as a result of being a poet?
Well, you know, it's, who am I as a result? I think you've asked me this question before, and I think I've kind of stumbled on it the last time.
All right.
Come as a result. I think I've become a lot more confident about reading my work. I think I was a secret poet for many years, and I probably would have continued to do that, but I bumped into Sam Cornish at the New England Mobile Book Fair in the stacks one day and was stunned that this person that I'd heard, the first poet I ever heard read when I was a teenager, was in Boston. I didn't know. I had been in my own little world with, you know, my raising my children with my husband and teaching and practicing law and doing a million things, and it had just not been on my radar. So I was lucky to encounter him, because when he said come to these poetry workshops, I began to realize that maybe some of what I'd been secretly writing, or not secretly writing, but writing and not sharing for all those years, with some work, could really be interesting to people out there.
Right.
And I think,
thank
of
you.
Course, the Internet has even made it easier. So.
Oh, very much so. I agree with that 100%. Yeah. I'd like to bring the other poets back into the conversation. Hold on one second. Francine, are you there?
I'm still here. Hi.
Hi.
All right, Pamela, hello, hello. I'd like to thank all three of you, and I'd like you to favor me by each one of you sharing one more piece of your work, one more piece, and then we'll close out.
Okay. All right. Should I go first?
But I have a question first. We're celebrating her story. Why is that important?
Is that a question for Francine or for everybody?
For anyone. Why is her story important?
Well, if you look at the canon, I mean, all the poets that I read as an English major and then as a graduate student, up until you got, I mean, with the exception of like Emily Dickinson and H.D. and Ann Bradstreet, you know, we were reading guys. We were reading old white guys. We were reading occasionally, you know, we'd make it into the 20th century and we could read Allen Ginsberg. And then, of course, there were all the confessional poets like Anne Sexton and Sylvia Plath. But I'm looking at my bookshelf right now. You know, I'm looking at, there's Allen Ginsberg and there's Shakespeare and there's, you know, Ezra Pound and there's Robert Frost and so on and so forth and Philip Sidney. And so I think it's about time. We got a lot of time to make up here.
Yes, I agree with that. Other thoughts? Well, if there are no other thoughts, I'd like to turn it over to
people
Francis.
People are saying, I can hear the people are thinking.
You hear the wheel
think?
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to turn it over to Francine for a final poem.
Okay, I'll read one last one. This is called Socks. After the service, Hans took your gold Viking ring. Your family took what they could sell. And I took your socks, densely cushioned $25 smart wool socks, 7 pairs in 7 colors, deep pile socks made for big men and cold weather trekking. By now, Hans has resized the ring and wears it like a wedding band, his affection ever on exhibit. Your family has peddled the loot and split the take from your King Harold collectibles, your Norman throwing axe, all the curiosities you loved. I wear your socks under my dress boots, 1 pair for each day of the week, a private secret that has linked us through every winter. When one went missing in the dryer cycle, that old machine was always eating socks, I lay my face in the basket of clean wash and wept. The lost sock appeared days later on the steps in the laundry room. I laughed and wished aloud that you would perform the same trick. The anniversary date comes and people ask me if I have closure, if I have recovered, if I have moved on. I nod, stifle my reproach, and scrunch my toes into the deep pile of your $25 smart wool socks. The end.
Thank you. Pamela? Hello?
Uh-oh. Where has Pamela gone?
Pamela's gone. All right.
I'm right here. I'm here.
Oh, there
okay.
You are.
Okay.
Come back.
Okay. All right. Fantastic. Share one more of your works.
Sure. I'm going to share this poem called Life is But a Dream. Life is but a dream. In my dream, the detective was looking for a woman in trouble. He went to her apartment, trying to find the danger in the tremble of her voice. She insisted that a man wanted to do her harm, but the detective found no threat, no man, nothing. The camera of my dream mind revealed that the detective had it all wrong. The building, the floor, the apartment. Then it panned to the man she described. Big and bald, jagged smile stained red, shirt arms ripped from her clawing. The authorities rushed in, but not one person stopped the brutal man from walking away.
The camera of my dream mind dared to peer inside the apartment where the beaten woman writhed in a pool of blood, hers and her attackers. It pulled away from the scene before I could tell if she would survive her open wounds. My mind lost focus and went dark. I woke up staring at the ceiling, body curled into a ball. I've had enough of these dreams to know that they reflect what I consume every day. The horror, the silence. I am the detective who got it wrong. The woman left waiting, the menace walking free, the people who didn't stop him, the camera fixated, the audience who sat there entertained. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. Lynn, bring us home.
Well, I was going to read another poem, but I thought, oh, I have a dream poem. I'm going to read my dream poem.
All right.
Mine is
All right.
quite different from Pam. So. It's called Twin Dream. He appeared out of nowhere, much younger than he is, slender, prematurely balding, full sideburns and a beard, with that urgency in his voice I remember so well. He was breathless, agitated. A twin baby, he said. I want a twin baby. Not both, just the one. Did he want me to produce the child, push it out, find one somewhere for him? And why, I wondered, with two grown sons, two daughters raised up and on their way, would he want a baby? And why a twin? And what of the other, the second twin? Did his wife want the twin baby too, or was this some harebrained idea leaping out of his 70-year-old head like Athena shot out of the head of Zeus? I sank back into sleep. The snowplow sent electronic beeps up and down the street outside, backing up, punctuating each task with staccato signals. Flannel sheets, feathered comforter weighed on me. I was in a sweat, the bedroom window open only a quarter inch, the humidifier humming, be quiet, be quiet. Still, he insisted, a baby, a twin. I propped myself up on an elbow, saw last night's book splayed on the night table. The plows spoke to each other. I fell back asleep, this time in a dreamless state. When day came, I looked out to see the trucks had done their work, dismantled the snow hills and carried them off. The sidewalks were cleared.
Well, on that note...
The end. Sorry, I forgot to say the end.
Yeah.
That was the end. The sidewalks were cleared. Sorry.
Well, on that note, I'd like to thank all of you for sharing your work with us tonight. I'd like to invite all of you to come back again later in the year to have your own night of poetry. This has been great. It's so
thank
important
you
to have
so much, Michael.
Well,
yeah,
thank you.
Thank
you. Let me say this really quickly. It's important to have opportunities to share, to be able to lift your voice and to just put it out there, So, again, thanks to all of you, to all of our listeners. Please join in next week. Tune in next week, and thank you so much, and have a good night. Good night, everyone.
Thank you, Michael.
You.
Good night.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you,
good
Pam,
night.
And thank you, Francine.
Good night. You too. Good night. Thank you.